the way he want to. I say, let him talk, even if we be upset by what he's saying. He's mad, got to get it out. Otherwise, he gonna keep on keeping it, and it's gonna blow him right on up.
I'm sorry, Zakaria said. Maybe her cells have done good for some people, but I would have rather had my mother. If she hadn't have been sacrificed, I might have growed up to be a lot better person than I am now.
Deborah stood from the bed where she'd been sitting with her grandson's heads on her lap. She walked over to Zakaria and put her arm around his waist.
Come on, walk us out to the car, she said. I got something I want to give you.
Outside, Deborah threw open the back of her Jeep and rummaged through blankets, clothes, and papers until she turned around holding the photo of Henrietta's chromosomes that Christoph Langauer had given her. She smoothed her fingers across the glass, then handed it to Zakaria.
These supposed to be her cells?
He asked.
Deborah nodded. See where it's stained bright colors? That's where all her DNA at.
Zakaria raised the picture to eye level and stared in silence. Deborah rubbed her hand on his back and whispered,
I think if anybody deserved that,
it's you, Zakaria.
Zakaria turned the picture to see it from every angle.
You want me to have this,
he said finally.
Yeah, I'd like you to have that. Put it on your wall, Deborah said.
Zakaria's eyes filled with tears. For a moment, the dark circles seemed to vanish, and his body relaxed.
Yeah, he said in a soft voice, unlike anything we'd heard that day.
He put his arm on Deborah's shoulder.
Hey, thanks.
Deborah wrapped her arms as far around his waist as she could reach and squeezed.
The doctor who gave me that said he'd been working with our mother for his whole career, and he never knew anything about where they came from. He said he was sorry.
Zakaria looked at me.
What's his name?
I told him, then said, he wants to meet you and show you the cells. Zakaria nodded, his arm still around Deborah's shoulder.
Okay, he said. That sounds good. Let's go for it.
Then he walked slowly back to his building, holding the picture in front of him at eye level, seeing nothing ahead but the DNA in his mother's cells.
Chapter 31. Hela, Goddess of Death. 2000 to 2001. The day after I got home from our marathon visit, a man Deborah didn't know called her asking if she'd ride on a Hela float in a black rodeo. He told her to be careful of people looking to find out where Henrietta's grave was, because they might want to steal her bones, since her body was so valuable to science. Deborah told the man she'd been talking to me for a book, and he warned her not to talk to white people about her story. She panicked and called her brother Lawrence, who told her the man was right, so she left me a message saying she couldn't talk to me anymore. But by the time I got the message and called her back, she'd changed her mind.
Everybody always yelling, racism, racism. That white man stole that black woman's cells. That white man killed that black woman. That's crazy talk, she told me. We all black and white and everything else. This isn't a race thing. There's two sides to the story, and that's what we want to bring out. Nothing about my mother is truth if it's about wanting to fry the researchers. It's not about punish the doctors or slander the hospital. I don't want that.
Deborah and I would go on like this for a full year. Each time I visited, we'd walk the Baltimore Harbor, ride boats, read science books together, and talk about her mother's cells. We took Davon and Alfred to the Maryland Science Center, where they saw a 20-foot wall covered floor to ceiling with a picture of cells stained neon green and magnified under a microscope.
Davon grabbed my hand and pulled me toward the wall of cells, yelling, "Miss Rebecca! Miss Rebecca! Is that great-grandma Henrietta?" People nearby stared as I said, "Actually, they might be." And Davon pranced around, singing, "Grandma Henrietta famous! Grandma Henrietta famous!" At one point, as Deborah and I walked along the cobblestone streets of Fells Point late at night, she turned to me and without prompting said, "I'll bring them medical records out on my terms and when I think is right." She told me that the night she tackled her mother's medical records and ran home, she'd thought I was trying to steal them. She said, "I just need somebody I can trust, somebody that will talk to me and don't keep me in the dark." She asked me to promise I wouldn't hide anything from her. I promised I wouldn't. Between trips, Deborah and I would spend hours each week talking over the phone. Occasionally, someone would convince her she couldn't trust a white person to tell her mother's story, and she'd call me in a panic, demanding to know whether Hopkins was paying me to get information from her like people said. Other times, she'd get suspicious about money, like when a genetics textbook publisher called offering her $300 for permission to print the photo of Henrietta. When Deborah said they had to give her $25,000 and they said no, she called me demanding to know who was paying me to write my book and how much I was going to give her. Each time, I told her the same thing. I hadn't sold the book yet, so at that point, I was paying for my research with student loans and credit cards. And regardless, I couldn't pay her for her story. Instead, I said, if the book ever got published, I would set up a scholarship fund for descendants of Henrietta Lacks. On Deborah's good days, she was excited about the idea. "Education is everything," she'd say. "If I'd had more of it, maybe this whole thing about my mother wouldn't have been so hard. That's why I'm always telling Davon, keep on studying, learning all you can." But on bad days, she'd think I was lying and cut me off again. Those moments never lasted long, and they always ended with Deborah asking me to promise, yet again, that I'd never hide anything from her. Eventually, I told her she could even come with me when I did some of my research if she wanted, and she said, "I want to go to centers and colleges and all that, learn in places, and I want to get the medical record and autopsy report on my sister." I began sending her stacks of information I uncovered about her mother. Scientific journal articles, photos of the cells, even an occasional novel, poem, or short story based on Gila. In one, a mad scientist used Gila as a biological weapon to spread rabies. Another featured yellow house paint made of Gila cells that could talk. I sent Deborah news of exhibits where several artists projected Henrietta's cells on walls. And one displayed a heart-shaped culture she'd grown by fusing her own cells with Gila. With each packet, I sent notes explaining what each thing meant, clearly labeling what was fiction and what wasn't, and warning her about anything that might upset her. Each time Deborah got a package, she'd call to talk about what she read, and gradually, her panicked calls grew less frequent. Soon after she realized I was the same age as her daughter, she started calling me Boo and insisted I buy a cell phone because she worried about me driving the interstates alone. Each time I talked to her brothers, she'd yell at them, only half-joking, saying, "Don't you try to take my reporter. Go get your own." When we met for our first trip, Deborah got out of her car wearing a black ankle-length skirt, black sandals with heels, and a black shirt covered with an open black cardigan. After we hugged, she said, "I got on my reporter clothes." She pointed at my black button-up shirt, black pants, and black boots, and said, "You always wear black, so I figured I should dress like you so I blend in." For each trip, Deborah filled her Jeep floor-to-ceiling with every kind of shoes and clothes she might need. "You never know when the weather's gonna change." She brought pillows and blankets in case we got stranded somewhere, an oscillating fan in case she got hot, plus all her haircutting and manicure equipment from beauty school, boxes of videotapes, music CDs, office supplies, and every document she had related to Henrietta. We always took two cars, because Deborah didn't trust me enough to ride with me yet. I'd follow behind, watching her black driving cap bob up and down to her music. Sometimes, when we rounded curves or stopped at lights, I could hear her belting out Born to Be Wild, or her favorite William Bell song, I Forgot to Be Your Lover. Eventually, Deborah let me come to her house. It was dark, with thick closed curtains, black couches, dim lights, and deep brown wood-paneled walls lined with religious scenes on blacklight posters. We spent all our time in her office, where she slept most nights instead of the bedroom she shared with Pullum. They fought a lot, she told me, and needed some peace. Her room was about 6 feet wide, with a twin bed against one wall and a small desk directly across from it, nearly touching the bed. On top of the desk, stacked beneath reams of paper, boxes of envelopes, letters, and bills, was her mother's Bible, its pages warped, cracking with age, and spotted with mold. Her mother's and sister's hair still tucked inside. Deborah's walls were covered floor to ceiling with colorful photos of bears, horses, dogs, and cats she'd torn from calendars, as well as nearly a dozen bright felt squares she and Davon had made by hand. One was yellow with, "Thank you, Jesus, for loving me," written in big letters. Another said, "Prophecies fulfilled," and was covered with coins made of tinfoil. A shelf at the head of her bed was crammed with videotapes of infomercials for a jacuzzi, an RV, a trip to Disneyland. Nearly every night, Deborah would say, "Hey, Davon, you want to go on vacation?" When he nodded yes, she'd ask, "Where you want to go? Disneyland, spa, or RV trip?" They'd watched each tape many times. At the end of one visit, I showed Deborah how to get online with an old computer someone had given her years earlier, then taught her to use Google. Soon she started taking Ambien, a narcotic sleep aid, and sitting up nights in a drugged haze, listening to William Bell on headphones, Googling Henrietta and Gila. Davon referred to Deborah's Ambien as dummy medicine because it made her wander the house in the middle of the night like a zombie, talking nonsense and trying to cook breakfast by chopping cereal with a butcher knife. When he stayed with her, Davon often woke up in the middle of the night to find Deborah sleeping at her computer, head down and hands on the keyboard. He'd just push her off the chair into bed and tuck her in. When Davon wasn't there, Deborah often woke up with her face on the desk, surrounded by a mountain of pages that spilled from her printer onto the floor. Scientific articles, patent applications, random newspaper articles and blog posts, including many that had no connection to her mother, but used the words Henrietta or Lax or Gila. And surprisingly, there were many of the latter. Gila is the native name for the country of Sri Lanka, where activists carry signs demanding justice for the Gila Nation. It's the name of a defunct German tractor company and an award-winning Shih Tzu dog. It's a seaside resort in Poland, an advertising firm in Switzerland, a Danish boat where people gather to drink vodka and watch films, and a Marvel comic book character who appears in several online games, a 7-foot-tall, half-black, half-white goddess who's part dead and part alive, with immeasurable intelligence, superhuman strength, godlike stamina and durability, and 500 pounds of solid muscle. She's responsible for plagues, sickness, and catastrophes. She's immune to fire, radiation, toxins, corrosives, disease, and aging. She can also levitate and control people's minds. When Deborah found pages describing Gila, the Marvel character, she thought they were describing her mother, since each of Gila's traits in some way matched what Deborah had heard about her mother's cells. But it turned out the sci-fi Gila was inspired by the ancient Norse goddess of death, who lives trapped in a land between hell and the living. Deborah figured that goddess was based on her mother, too. One day, around 3 o'clock in the morning, my phone rang as I slept, feverish with flu. Deborah yelled on the other end, "I told you London cloned my mother!" Her voice was slow and slurred from Ambien. She'd Googled HeLa, clone, London, and DNA, and gotten thousands of hits with summaries like this from an online chat room discussion about HeLa cells. Each contains a genetic blueprint for constructing Henrietta Lacks. Can we clone her? Her mother's name showed up under headlines like cloning and human farming, and she thought those thousands of hits were proof that scientists had cloned thousands of Henriettas. "They didn't clone her," I said. "They just made copies of her cells, I promise."
"Thanks, Boo. I'm sorry I woke you," she cooed. "But if they cloning her cells, does that mean someday they could clone my mother?"
"No," I said. "Good night." After several weeks of finding Deborah unconscious, with her phone in her hand or face on the keyboard, Davon told his mother he needed to stay at his grandmother's house all the time to take care of her after she took her medicine. Deborah took an average of 14 pills a day, which cost her about $150 each month after her husband's insurance, plus Medicaid and Medicare.
"I think it's 11 prescriptions," she told me once. "Maybe 12. I can't keep track. They change all the time."
One for acid reflux went from $8 one month to $135 the next, so she stopped taking it. And at one point, her husband's insurance canceled her prescription coverage, so she started cutting her pills in half to make them last. When the Ambien ran out, she stopped sleeping until she got more. She told me her doctor started prescribing the drugs in 1997 after what she referred to as the gold digger situation, which she refused to tell me about. That was when she'd applied for Social Security disability, she said, which she only got after several court appearances.
"Social Security people said everything was all in my head," she told me. "They ended up sending me to about 5 psychiatrists and a bunch of doctors. They say I'm paranoia, I'm schizophrenia, I'm nervous. I got anxiety, depression, degenerating kneecaps, bursitis, bulged discs in my back, diabetes, osteoporosis, high blood pressure, cholesterol. I don't know all of what's wrong with me by name," she said. "I don't know if anyone do. All I know is, when I get in that mood and I get frightened, I hide."
"That's what happened the first time I called," she said.
"I was all excited, saying, I want a book written about my mother. Then things just started going in my head and I got scared. I know my life could be better, and I wish it was," she told me. "When people hear about my mother's cells, they always say, 'Ah, y'all could be rich. Y'all got to sue John Hopkins. Y'all got to do this and that.' But I don't want that," she laughed. "Truth be told, I can't get mad at science because it helped people live, and I'd be a mess without it. I'm a walking drugstore. I can't say nothing bad about science, but I won't lie. I would like some health insurance, so I don't got to pay all that money every month for drugs my mother's cells probably helped make."
Eventually, as Deborah grew comfortable with the internet, she started using it for more than terrifying herself in the middle of the night. She made lists of questions for me and printed articles about research done on people without their knowledge or consent. From a vaccine trial in Uganda to the testing of drugs on U.S. troops, she started organizing information into carefully labeled folders, one about cells, another about cancer, another full of definitions of legal terms like statute of limitations and patient confidentiality. At one point, she stumbled on an article called "What's Left of Henrietta Lacks, that infuriated her by saying Henrietta had probably gotten HPV because she slept around.
"Them people don't know nothing about science," she told me. "Just having HPV don't mean my mother was loose. Most people got it. I read about it on the internet."
Then, in April 2001, nearly a year after we met, Deborah called me to tell me that the president of a cancer club had called wanting to put her on stage at an event honoring her mother. She was worried, she said, and she wanted me to find out if he was legit. He turned out to be Franklin Salisbury, Jr., president of the National Foundation for Cancer Research. He'd decided to hold the foundation's 2001 conference in Henrietta's honor. On September 13th, 70 top cancer researchers from around the world would gather to present their research, he said, and hundreds of people would attend, including the mayor of Washington, D.C., and the Surgeon General. He hoped Deborah would speak there and accept a plaque in her mother's honor.
"I understand that the family feels very abused," he told me. "We can't give them money, but I'm hoping this conference will set the historic record straight and help make them feel better, even if we are 50 years late."
When I explained this to Deborah, she was ecstatic. It would be just like Patillo's conference in Atlanta, she said, only bigger. She immediately started planning what she'd wear and asking questions about what the researchers would be talking about. And she worried again about whether she'd be safe on stage or whether there'd be a sniper waiting for her.
"What if they think I'm going to cause trouble about them taking the cells or something?"
"I don't think you need to worry about that," I said. "The scientists are excited to meet you." "Besides," I told her, "it was going to be in a federal building with high security."
"Okay," she said. "But first, I want to go see my mother's cells, so I know what everybody's talking about at the conference."
When we hung up, I went to call Christoph Langauer, the cancer researcher who'd given Deborah the painted chromosome picture. But before I could dig out his number, my phone rang again. It was Deborah, crying. I thought she was panicking, changing her mind about seeing the cells, but instead, she wailed,
"Oh, my baby. Lord, help him. They got him with fingerprints on a pizza box."
Her son Alfred and a friend had been on a crime spree, robbing at least 5 liquor stores at gunpoint. Security cameras caught Alfred on tape yelling at a store clerk and waving a bottle of Wild Irish Rose above his head. He'd stolen a 12-ounce bottle of beer, 1 bottle of Wild Irish Rose, 2 packs of Newport cigarettes, and about $100 in cash. The police arrested him in front of his house and threw him in the car, while his son, little Alfred, watched from the lawn.
"I still want to go see them cells,"
Deborah said, sobbing.
"I ain't gonna let this stop me from learning about my mother and my sister."
Chapter 32. All That's My Mother, 2001. By the time Deborah was ready to see her mother's cells for the first time, Day couldn't come. He'd said many times that he wanted to see his wife's cells before he died. But he was 85, in and out of the hospital with heart and blood pressure problems, and he'd just lost a leg to diabetes. Sonny had to work, and Lawrence said he wanted to talk to a lawyer about suing Hopkins instead of seeing the cells, which he referred to as a multi-billion-dollar corporation. So on May 11th, 2001, Deborah, Zakaria, and I agreed to meet at the Hopkins Jesus statue to go see Henrietta's cells. Earlier that morning, Deborah had warned me that Lawrence was convinced Hopkins was paying me to gather information about the family. He'd already called her several times that day, saying he was coming to get the materials she'd collected related to her mother. So Deborah locked them in her office, took the key with her, and called me, saying,
"Don't tell him where you are, or go see him without me."
When I arrived at the Jesus, it stood just as it had when Henrietta visited it some 50 years earlier, looming more than 10 feet tall beneath a tiered dome, pupilless marble eyes staring straight ahead, arms outstretched and draped in stone robes. At Jesus's feet, people had thrown piles of change, wilted daisies, and 2 roses, one fresh with thorns, the other cloth with plastic dewdrops. His body was gray-brown and dingy, except for his right foot, which glowed a polished white from decades of hands rubbing it for luck. Deborah and Zakaria weren't there, so I leaned against a far wall, watching a doctor in green scrubs kneel before the statue and pray, as others brushed its toe on their way into the hospital without looking or breaking stride. Several people stopped to write prayers in oversized books resting on wooden pedestals near the statue. "Dear Heavenly Father, if it is your will, let me speak to Eddie this one last time. Please help my sons conquer their addictions. I ask you to provide my husband and I with jobs. Lord, thank you for giving me another chance." I walked to the statue, my heels echoing on marble, and rested my hand on its big toe, the closest I'd ever come to praying. Suddenly, Deborah was beside me, whispering, "I hope he got our back on this one." Her voice was utterly calm, her usual nervous laugh gone. I told her I did too. Deborah closed her eyes and began to pray. Then Zakaria appeared behind us and let out a deep laugh.
"He can't do nothing to help you now," Zakaria yelled.
He'd gained weight since I'd seen him last, and his heavy gray wool pants and thick blue down coat made him look even bigger. The black plastic arms of his glasses were so tight they'd etched deep grooves into his head, but he couldn't afford new ones. He looked at me and said,
"That sister of mine, she crazy for not wanting money from them cells."
Deborah rolled her eyes and hit his leg with her cane.
"Be good, or you can't come see the cells," she said.
Zakaria stopped laughing and followed as we headed toward Christoph Langauer's lab. Minutes later, Christoph walked toward us through the lobby of his building, smiling, hand outstretched. He was in his mid-30s, with perfectly worn denim jeans, a blue plaid shirt, and shaggy light brown hair. He shook my hand and Deborah's, then reached for Zakaria's. But Zakaria didn't move.
"Okay," Christoph said, looking at Deborah. "It must be pretty hard for you to come into a lab at Hopkins after what you've been through. I'm really glad to see you here."
He spoke with an Austrian accent, which made Deborah wiggle her eyebrows at me when he turned to press the elevator call button.
"I thought we'd start in the freezer room, so I can show you how we store your mother's cells. Then we can go look at them alive under a microscope."
"That's wonderful,"
Deborah said, as though he'd just said something entirely ordinary. Inside the elevator, she pressed against Zakaria, one hand leaning on her cane, the other gripping her tattered dictionary. When the doors opened, we followed Christoph single file through a long, narrow hallway, its walls and ceiling vibrating with a deep whirring sound that grew louder as we walked.
"That's the ventilation system," Christoph yelled. "It sucks all the chemicals and cells outside so we don't have to breathe them in."
He threw open the door to his lab with a sweeping ta-da motion and waved us inside.
"This is where we keep all the cells,"
he yelled over a deafening mechanical hum that made Deborah's and Zakaria's hearing aids squeal. Zakaria's hand shot up and tore his from his ear. Deborah adjusted the volume on hers, then walked past Christoph into a room filled wall-to-wall with white freezers stacked one on top of the other, rumbling like a sea of washing machines in an industrial laundromat. She shot me a wide-eyed, terrified look. Christoph pulled the handle of a white floor-to-ceiling freezer, and it opened with a hiss, releasing a cloud of steam into the room. Deborah screamed and jumped behind Zakaria, who stood expressionless, hands in his pockets.
"Don't worry," Kristoff yelled. "It's not dangerous. It's just cold. They're not minus 20 Celsius like your freezers at home. They're minus 80. That's why, when I open them, smoke comes out."
He motioned for Deborah to come closer.
"It's all full of her cells," he said.
Deborah loosened her grip on Zakaria and inched forward until the icy breeze hit her face, and she stood staring at thousands of inch-tall plastic vials filled with red liquid.
"Oh, God," she gasped. "I can't believe all that's my mother."
Zakaria just stared in silence. Kristoff reached into the freezer, took out a vial, and pointed to the letters H-E-L-A written on its side.
"There are millions and millions of her cells in there," he said. "Maybe billions. You can keep them here forever. 50 years, 100 years, even more. Then you just thaw them out and they grow."
He rocked the vial of HeLa cells back and forth in his hand as he started talking about how careful you have to be when you handle them.
"We have an extra room just for the cells," he said. "That's important, because if you contaminate them with anything, you can't really use them anymore, and you don't want HeLa cells to contaminate other cultures in a lab."
"That's what happened over in Russia, right?"
Deborah said. He did a double take and grinned.
"Yes," he said. "Exactly. It's great you know about that."
He explained how the HeLa contamination problem happened, then said,
"Her cells caused millions of dollars in damage. Seems like a bit of poetic justice, doesn't it?"
"My mother was just getting back at scientists for keeping all them secrets from the family," Deborah said. "You don't mess with Henrietta. She'll sick HeLa on your ass."
Everyone laughed. Kristoff reached into the freezer behind him, grabbed another vial of HeLa cells, and held it out to Deborah, his eyes soft. She stood stunned for a moment, staring into his outstretched hand, then grabbed the vial and began rubbing it fast between her palms like she was warming herself in winter.
"She's cold,"
Deborah said, cupping her hands and blowing onto the vial. Kristoff motioned for us to follow him to the incubator where he warmed the cells, but Deborah didn't move. As Zakaria and Kristoff walked away, she raised the vial and touched it to her lips.
"You're famous," she whispered. "Just nobody knows it."
Kristoff led us into a small laboratory crammed full of microscopes, pipettes, and containers with words like biohazard and DNA written on their sides. Pointing to the ventilation hoods covering his tables, he said,
"We don't want cancer all over the place, so this sucks all the air into a filtration system that catches and kills any cells that are floating around."
He explained what culture medium was, and how he moved cells from freezer to incubator to grow.
"Eventually, they fill those huge bottles in the back," he said, pointing to rows of gallon-sized jugs. "Then we do our experiments on them. Like we find a new drug for cancer, pour it onto the cells, and see what happens."
Zakaria and Deborah nodded as he told them how drugs go through testing in cells, then animals, and finally humans. Kristoff knelt in front of an incubator, reached inside, and pulled out a dish with HeLa growing in it.
"They're really, really small, the cells," he said. "That's why we go to the microscope now, so I can show them to you."
He flipped power switches, slid the dish onto the microscope's platform, and pointed to a small monitor attached to the microscope. It lit up a fluorescent green, and Deborah gasped.
"It's a pretty color."
Kristoff bent over the microscope to bring the cells into focus, and an image appeared on the screen that looked more like hazy green pond water than cells.
"At this magnification, you can't see much," Kristoff said. The screen is just boring, because the cells are so small, even with a microscope you can't see them sometimes.
He clicked a knob and zoomed in to higher and higher magnifications, until the hazy sea of green turned into a screen filled with hundreds of individual cells, their centers dark and bulging.
"Ooh," Deborah whispered. "There they are."
She reached out and touched the screen, rubbing her finger from one cell to the next. Christoph traced the outline of a cell with his finger.
"All this is one cell," he said. "It kind of looks like a triangle with a circle in the middle. You see that?"
He grabbed a piece of scrap paper and spent nearly a half hour drawing diagrams and explaining the basic biology of cells as Deborah asked questions. Zakaria turned up his hearing aid and leaned close to Christoph and the paper.
"Everybody always talking about cells and DNA," Deborah said at one point. "But I don't understand what's DNA and what's her cells."
"Ah," Christoph said, excited. "DNA is what's inside the cell. Inside each nucleus, if we could zoom in closer, you could see a piece of DNA that looked like this."
He drew a long, squiggly line.
"There's 46 of those pieces of DNA in every human nucleus. We call those chromosomes. Those are the things that were colored bright in that big picture I gave you."
"Oh, my brother got that picture hanging on his wall at home next to our mother and sister," Deborah said, then looked at Zakaria. "Did you know this is the man who gave you that picture?"
Zakaria looked to the ground and nodded, the corners of his mouth turning up into a barely perceptible smile.
"Within the DNA in that picture is all the genetic information that made Henrietta Henrietta," Christoph told them. "Was your mother tall or short?"
"Short."
"And she had dark hair, right?"
We all nodded.
"Well, all that information came from her DNA," he said. "So did her cancer. It came from a DNA mistake."
Deborah's face fell. She'd heard many times that she'd inherited some of the DNA inside those cells from her mother. She didn't want to hear that her mother's cancer was in that DNA, too.
"Those mistakes can happen when you get exposed to chemicals or radiation," Christoph said. "But in your mother's case, the mistake was caused by HPV, the genital warts virus. The good news for you is that children don't inherit those kinds of changes in DNA from their parents. They just come from being exposed to the virus."
"So we don't have the thing that made her cells grow forever?" Deborah asked.
Christoph shook his head.
"Now you tell me after all these years?" Deborah yelled. "Thank God! 'Cause I was wondering."
She pointed at a cell on the screen that looked longer than the others.
"This one is cancer, right? And the rest are her normal ones?"
"Actually, Hila is all just cancer," Christoph said.
"Wait a minute," she said. "You mean none of our mother regular cells still living? Just her cancer cells?"
"That's right."
"Oh, see, in all this time I thought my mother regular cells still living."
Christoph leaned over the microscope again and began moving the cells quickly around the screen until he shrieked,
"Look there! See that cell?"
He pointed to the center of the monitor.
"See how it has a big nucleus that looks like it's almost pinched in half in the middle? That cell is dividing into two cells right before our eyes. And both of those cells will have your mother's DNA in them."
"Lord have mercy,"
Deborah whispered, covering her mouth with her hand. Christoph kept talking about cell division, but Deborah wasn't listening. She stood mesmerized, watching one of her mother's cells divide in two, just as they'd done when Henrietta was an embryo in her mother's womb. Deborah and Zakaria stared at the screen like they'd gone into a trance, mouths open, cheeks sagging.
It was the closest they'd come to seeing their mother alive since they were babies. After a long silence, Zakaria spoke.
"If those are mother's cells," he said, "how come they ain't black, even though she was black?"
"Under the microscope, cells don't have a color," Christoph told him.
"They all look the same. They're just clear until we put color on them with a dye. You can't tell what color a person is from their cells."
He motioned for Zakaria to come closer. "Would you like to look at them through the microscope? They look better there."
Christoph taught Debra and Zakaria how to use the microscope, saying,
"Look through this. Take your glasses off. Now, turn this knob to focus."
Finally, the cells popped into view for Debra. And through that microscope, for that moment, all she could see was an ocean of her mother's cells, stained an ethereal fluorescent green.
"They're beautiful," she whispered, then went back to staring at the slide in silence. Eventually, without looking away from the cells, she said,
"God, I never thought I'd see my mother under a microscope. I never dreamed this day would ever come."
"Yeah, Hopkins pretty much screwed up, I think," Christoph said.
Debra bolted upright and looked at him, stunned to hear a scientist, one at Hopkins, no less, saying such a thing. Then she looked back into the microscope and said,
"John Hopkins is a school for learning, and that's important. But this is my mother. Nobody seemed to get that."
"It's true," Christoph said. "Whenever we read books about science, it's always Hela this and Hela that. Some people know those are the initials of a person, but they don't know who that person is. That's important history."
Debra looked like she wanted to hug him.
"This is amazing," she said, shaking her head and looking at him like he was a mirage.
Suddenly, Zakaria started yelling something about George Guy. Debra thumped her cane on his toe and he stopped in mid-sentence.
"Zakaria has a lot of anger with all this that's been going on," she told Christoph. "I've been trying to keep him calm. Sometime he explode, but he's trying." "I don't blame you for being angry," Christoph said.
Then he showed them the catalog he used to order Hela cells. There was a long list of the different Hela clones anyone could buy for $167 a vial.
"You should get that,"
Christoph said to Debra and Zakaria.
"Yeah, right," Debra said. "What am I going to do with a vial of my mother's cells?" She laughed. "No, I mean, you should get the money, at least some of it."
"Oh," she said, stunned.
"That's okay. You know, when people hear about who Hela was, first thing they say is, y'all should be millionaires."
Christoph nodded.
"Her cells are how it all started," he said. "Once there is a cure for cancer, it's definitely largely because of your mother's cells."
"Amen," Debra said.
Then, without a hint of anger, she told him,
"People always gonna be making money from those cells. Nothing we can do about that. But we not gonna get any of it."
Christoph said he thought that was wrong. "Why not treat valuable cells like oil?" he said. "When you find oil on somebody's property, it doesn't automatically belong to them, but they do get a portion of the profits."
"No one knows how to deal with this when it comes to cells today," he said. "When your mother got sick, doctors just did what they wanted and patients didn't ask. But nowadays, patients want to know what's going on."
"Amen," Debra said again.
Christoph gave them his cell phone number and said they could call any time they had questions about their mother's cells. As we walked toward the elevator, Zakaria reached up and touched Christoph on the back and said thank you. Outside, he did the same to me, then turned to catch the bus home.
Debra and I stood in silence, watching him walk away. Then she put her arm around me and said, "Girl, you just witnessed a miracle." Chapter 33. The Hospital for the Negro Insane, 2001. There were several things I'd promised Debra we'd do together. Seeing her mother's cells was first. Figuring out what happened to Elsie was second. So the day after we visited Christoph's lab, Debra and I set out on a week-long trip that would start at Crownsville, where we hoped to find her sister's medical records, then go through Clover and end in Roanoke, at the house where Henrietta was born. It was Mother's Day, which had always been a sad day for Debra, and this one hadn't started well. She'd planned to take her grandson, Alfred, to see his father in jail before we left town. But her son had called, saying he didn't want Debra or little Alfred visiting until he could see them without looking through glass. He told her he wanted to learn about his grandmother, Henrietta, and asked Debra to send him whatever information we found on our trip. "I've been waiting for him to say that his whole life," she told me, crying. "I just didn't want him to have to get locked up in prison to do it." But once again, she said, "I'm not going to let that stop me. I just want to focus on the good, like seeing my mother's cells and learning about my sister." So we drove to Crownsville in our separate cars. I don't know what I expected the former hospital for the Negro insane to look like, but it certainly wasn't what we found. Crownsville Hospital Center was on a sprawling 1,200-acre campus, with bright green hills, perfectly mowed lawns, walking paths, weeping cherry trees, and picnic tables. Its main building was red brick with white columns, its porch decorated with wide chairs and chandeliers. It looked like a nice place to sip mint juleps or sweet tea. One of the old hospital buildings was now a food bank. Others housed the Police Criminal Investigation Division, an alternative high school, and a Rotary Club. Inside the main building, we walked past empty offices in a long, empty white hallway, saying, "Hello," and "Where is everybody?" and "This place is weird." Then, at the end of the hall, was a white door covered with years' worth of dirt and handprints. It had the words, "Medical Records," stenciled across it in broken block letters. Beneath that, in smaller letters, it said, "No thoroughfare." Debra gripped the door handle and took a deep breath. "We ready for this?" she asked. I nodded. She grabbed my arm with one hand, threw the door open with the other, and we stepped inside. We found ourselves in a thick white metal cage that opened into the medical records room, an empty, warehouse-sized room with no staff, no patients, no chairs, no visitors, and no medical records. Its windows were bolted shut and covered with wire and dirt, its gray carpet bunched in ripples from decades of foot traffic. A waist-high cinder block wall ran the length of the room, separating the waiting area from the area marked "Authorized Personnel Only," where several rows of tall metal shelves stood empty. "I can't believe this," Debra whispered. "All them records is gone?" She ran her hand along the empty shelves, mumbling, 1955 was the year where they killed her. I want them records. I know it wasn't good. Why else would they get rid of them?" No one had to tell us something awful had happened at Crownsville. We could feel it in the walls. "Let's go find someone who can tell us something," I said. We wandered into another long hallway, and Debra began screaming, "Excuse me! We need to find the medical record. Does anyone know where it is?" Eventually, a young woman poked her head out of an office and pointed us down the hall to another office, where someone pointed us to yet another. Finally, we found ourselves in the office of a tall man with a thick white Santa Claus beard and wild bushy eyebrows. Deborah charged over to him, saying, "Hi, I'm Deborah, and this is my reporter. You may have heard of us. My mama's in history with the cells, and we need to find some medical record." The man smiled.
"Who was your mother?" he asked. "And what are the cells?"
We explained why we were there, and he told us that the current medical records were in another building and that there wasn't much history left at Crownsville.
"I wish we had an archivist," he said. "I'm afraid I'm as close as you'll get."
His name was Paul Lurs, and he was the hospital's director of performance and improvement. But he also happened to be a social worker who'd majored in history, which was his passion. He motioned for us to come sit in his office.
"There wasn't much funding for treating blacks in the 40s and 50s, he said. "I'm afraid Crownsville wasn't a very nice place to be back then."
He looked at Deborah.
"Your sister was here?"
She nodded.
"Tell me about her."
"My father always say she never went past a child in her head," she said, reaching into her purse for a crumpled copy of Elsie's death certificate, which she began reading slowly out loud.
"Elsie Lacks, cause of death, A, respiratory failure, B, epilepsy, C, cerebral palsy, spent 5 years in Crownsville State Hospital."
She handed Lurs the picture of her sister that Zakaria had hanging on his wall.
"I don't believe my sister had all that."
Lurs shook his head.
"She doesn't look like she has palsy in this picture. What a lovely child." "She did have them seizures," Deborah said, "and she couldn't ever learn how to use the toilet. But I think she was just deaf. Me and all my brothers got a touch of nerve deafness on account of our mother and father being cousins and having the syphilis. Sometimes I wonder if somebody taught her sign language, maybe she'd still be alive."
Lurs sat in his chair, legs crossed, looking at the photo of Elsie.
"You have to be prepared," he told Deborah, his voice gentle. "Sometimes learning can be just as painful as not knowing."
"I'm ready," Deborah said, nodding.
"We had a serious asbestos problem," he said. "Most of our records from the 50s and earlier were contaminated. Instead of cleaning each page of the records to save them, the administration decided to have them carted away in bags and buried."
He walked to a storage closet near his desk, its walls lined with shelves and file cabinets. In the back corner, he'd crammed a small desk facing the wall. Lurs had been working at Crownsville since 1964, when he was a student intern in his 20s, and he had a habit of collecting potentially historic documents. Patient records, copies of old admissions reports that caught his attention. An infant admitted blind in one eye with facial deformities and no family. A child institutionalized without any apparent psychiatric disorder. Lurs disappeared into the closet and began muttering amid loud clunking and shuffling noises.
"There were a few. I just had them out a couple weeks ago. Ah, here we go."
He walked out of the closet, carrying a stack of oversized books with thick leather spines and dark green cloth covers. They were warped with age, coated in dust, and filled with thick yellowed paper.
"These are the autopsy reports," he said, opening the first book as the scent of mildew filled the room.
He'd found them while rummaging in the basement of an abandoned building at the hospital sometime in the 80s, he said. When he'd first opened them, hundreds of bugs scurried from the pages onto his desk. Between 1910, when the hospital opened, and the late 50s, when the records were found to be contaminated, tens of thousands of patients passed through Crownsville. Their records, if they'd survived, could have filled Lurs's small storage room several times over. Now, this stack was all that was left at Crownsville. Lurs pulled out a volume that included some reports from 1955, the year Elsie died, and Deborah squealed with excitement.
What did you say her full name was? Lurs asked, running his finger down a list of names written in careful script next to the page numbers.
Elsie Lax, I said, scanning the names over his shoulder as my heart raced. Then, in a daze, I pointed to the words Elsie Lax on the page and I said, "Oh my God, there she is."
Debra gasped, her face suddenly ashen. She closed her eyes, grabbed my arm to steady herself, and started whispering, "Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord."
"Wow. This really surprises me," Lurs said. "It was very unlikely she'd be in here."
Debra and I began hopping around and clapping. No matter what the record said, at least it would tell us something about Elsie's life, which we figured was better than knowing nothing at all. Lurs opened to Elsie's page, then quickly closed his eyes and pressed the book to his chest before we could see anything.
"I've never seen a picture in one of these reports," he whispered.
He lowered the book so we could all see, and suddenly time seemed to stop. The three of us stood, our heads nearly touching over the page, as Debra cried,
"Oh, my baby. She looked just like my daughter. She looked just like Davon. She looked just like my father. She got that smooth, olive-lax skin."
Lurs and I just stared, speechless. In the photo, Elsie stands in front of a wall painted with numbers for measuring height. Her hair, which Henrietta once spent hours combing and braiding, is frizzy, with thick mats that stop just below the 5-foot mark behind her. Her once beautiful eyes bulge from her head, slightly bruised and almost swollen shut. She stares somewhere just below the camera, crying, her face misshapen and barely recognizable, her nostrils inflamed and ringed with mucus. Her lips, swollen to nearly twice their normal size, are surrounded by a deep, dark ring of chapped skin. Her tongue is thick and protrudes from her mouth. She appears to be screaming. Her head is twisted unnaturally to the left, chin raised, and held in place by a large pair of white hands.
"She doesn't want her head like that," Debra whispered. "Why are they holding her head like that?"
No one spoke. We all just stood there, staring at those big white hands wrapped around Elsie's neck. They were well manicured and feminine, pinky slightly raised, hands you'd see in a commercial for nail polish, not wrapped around the throat of a crying child. Debra laid her old picture of Elsie as a young girl next to the new photo.
"Oh, she was beautiful," Lurs whispered.
Debra ran her finger across Elsie's face in the Crownsville photo.
"She looks like she wondering where I'm at," she said. "She looked like she needs her sister."
The photo was attached to the top corner of Elsie's autopsy report, which Lurs and I began reading, saying occasional phrases out loud. Diagnosis of idiocy, directly connected with syphilis. Self-induced vomiting by thrusting fingers down her throat for 6 months prior to death. In the end, it said, she was vomiting coffee ground material, which was probably clotted blood. Just as Lurs read the phrase, "vomiting coffee ground material," out loud, a short, round, balding man in a dark business suit stormed into the room, telling me to stop taking notes and demanding to know what we were doing there. "This is the family of a patient," Lurs snapped. "They're here to look at the patient's medical records." The man paused, looking at Debra, then at me. A short black woman in her 50s and a taller white woman in her 20s. Debra gripped her cane and stared him in the eye with a look that just begged him to mess with her. She reached into her bag and pulled out 3 pieces of paper. Her birth certificate, Elsie's birth certificate,
and the legal document giving her power of attorney over Elsie, something she'd spent months getting, just in case anyone tried to stop her from doing precisely what we were doing. She handed them to the man, who grabbed the autopsy report book and started reading. Debra and I glared at him, both so furious at him for trying to stop us that neither of us realized he was one of the only hospital officials who'd ever tried to protect the Lax family's privacy. "Can Debra get a copy of that autopsy report?" I asked Lurs. "Yes, she can," he said, "if she submits a written request." He grabbed a piece of paper from his desk and handed it to Debra. "What am I supposed to write?" she asked. Lurs began reciting, "I, Debra Lax." Within moments, she had an official medical record request on a torn piece of paper. She handed it to Lurs and told him, "I need a good blowed-up copy of that picture, too." Before Lurs left to make photocopies, with the bald man close behind, he handed me a stack of photos and documents to look at while he was gone. The first document in the stack was a Washington Post article from 1958, 3 years after Elsie's death, with the headline, "Overcrowded Hospital Loses Curable Patients. Lack of staff at Crownsville pushes them to chronic stage." The second I read the title, I flipped the article face down in my lap. For a moment, I considered not showing it to Debra. I thought maybe I should read it first, so I could prepare her for whatever awful thing we were about to learn. But she grabbed it from my hand and read the headline out loud, then looked up, her eyes dazed. "This is nice," she said, pointing to a large illustration that showed a group of men in various states of disrepair, holding their heads, lying on the floor, or huddling in corners. "I'd like to have this for my wall." She handed it back to me and asked me to read it out loud. "Are you sure?" I asked. "This is probably going to say some pretty upsetting things. Do you want me to read it first and tell you what it says?" "No," she snapped. "Like he told us, they didn't have the money to take care of black people." She walked behind me to follow along over my shoulder as I read. Then she scanned the page and pointed to several words on the page. "Gruesome," she said. "Fearsome black wards." The Crownsville that Elsie died in was far worse than anything Debra had imagined. Patients arrived from a nearby institution packed in a train car. In 1955, the year Elsie died, the population of Crownsville was at a record high of more than 2,700 patients, nearly 800 above maximum capacity. In 1948, the only year figures were available, Crownsville averaged one doctor for every 225 patients, and its death rate was far higher than its discharge rate. Patients were locked in poorly ventilated cell blocks with drains on the floor instead of toilets. Black men, women, and children, suffering with everything from dementia and tuberculosis to nervousness, lack of self-confidence, and epilepsy, were packed into every conceivable space, including windowless basement rooms and barred-in porches. When they had beds, they usually slept two or more on a twin mattress, lying head to foot, forced to crawl across a sea of sleeping bodies to reach their beds. Inmates weren't separated by age or sex, and often included sex offenders. There were riots and homemade weapons. Unruly patients were tied to their beds or secluded in locked rooms.
I later learned that while Elsie was at Crownsville, scientists often conducted research on patients there without consent, including one study titled "Pneumoencephalographic and Skull X-ray Studies in 100 Epileptics." Pneumoencephalography was a technique developed in 1919 for taking images of the brain, which floats in a sea of fluid. That fluid protects the brain from damage, but it makes it very difficult to X-ray, since images taken through fluid are cloudy.
Pneumoencephalography involved drilling holes into the skulls of research subjects, draining the fluid surrounding their brains, and pumping air or helium into the skull in place of the fluid to allow crisp X-rays of the brain through the skull. The side effects, crippling headaches, dizziness, seizures, vomiting, lasted until the body naturally refilled the skull with spinal fluid, which usually took 2 to 3 months. Because pneumoencephalography could cause permanent brain damage and paralysis, it was abandoned in the 1970s. There is no evidence that the scientists who did research on patients at Crownsville got consent from either the patients or their parents. Based on the number of patients listed in the pneumoencephalography study and the years it was conducted, Lurs told me later, it most likely involved every epileptic child in the hospital, including Elsie. The same is likely true of at least one other study, called The Use of Deep Temporal Leads in the Study of Psychomotor Epilepsy, which involved inserting metal probes into patients' brains. Soon after Elsie's death, a new warden took over at Crownsville and began releasing hundreds of patients who'd been institutionalized unnecessarily. The Washington Post article quoted him saying, "The worst thing you can do to a sick person is close the door and forget about him." When I read that line out loud, Deborah whispered, "We didn't forget about her. My mother died. Nobody told me she was here. I would have got her out." As we left Crownsville, Deborah thanked Lurs for the information, saying, "I've been waiting for this for a long, long time, Doc." When he asked if she was okay, her eyes welled with tears and she said, "Like I'm always telling my brothers, if you're gonna go into history, you can't do it with a hate attitude. You got to remember, times was different." When we got outside, I asked Deborah if she was sure she was all right. She just laughed like I was crazy. "It was such a good idea we decided to stop here," she said, then hurried to the parking lot, climbed into her car, and rolled the window down. "Where we going next?" Lurs had mentioned that any other remaining old records from Crownsville were stored at the Maryland State Archives in Annapolis, about 7 miles away. He didn't think they'd have any from the 50s, but figured it wouldn't hurt to look. "We going to Annapolis, see if they got more of my sister medical records?" "I don't know if that's a good idea," I said. "Don't you want a break?" "No way," she yelled. "We got lots more reporting to do. We just getting hot now." She screeched off in her car, smiling and waving the new picture of her sister out the window at me as I jumped in my car to follow. About 10 minutes later, as we pulled into the parking lot of the State Archives, Deborah bounced in the seat of